This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. It has been a tough year for President Obama regarding immigration policy. Just last month, federal judge Dolly G issued a ruling which concludes that immigrant children and their mothers cannot be held in unlicensed secure facilities while they await asylum hearings, secure meaning they're not free to come and go. Upwards of 1,000 mothers and children are in three such family detention centers, one in Pennsylvania, and the Obama administration hopes this will prove a deterrent to others who might consider crossing the border illegally. This hour, we take a close look at the Berks County Residential Center. Who is living there? And what are the living conditions? What comes next? Our guests include Matthew Archambault, an immigration lawyer. He is representing a number of women from the Berks Center. Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you.
And Franco Ordonez covers immigration for McClatchy. Great to have you here, Franco.
Thanks so much.
In this note, we did ask Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, to send a representative, but they declined to participate in this hour. So Judge G's tentative court ruling of last month concludes that immigrant children and their mothers cannot be held in secure facilities. How is the Berks facility secured? Matthew?
Well, this has been a little bit of a contention with the PA, the Pennsylvania government, Department of Human Services in Berks are claiming that it's an unsecured facility. I would point out that in court transcripts from the Flores settlement, from that court case, a government attorney did make the assertion that Berks was a secured facility. They're claiming it's an unsecured facility because they say the doors are unlocked so the children and mothers and other parents can freely egress from the building. However, that there's always a guard in front of those doors, and they cannot just leave whenever they want, even just to go out to the playground. They would need a guard to go with them and take them outside. They would need permission. So they're trying to fudge the meaning of secured or unsecured by saying, hey, the doors are unlocked. Perhaps they are. I certainly remember a few months ago before this became an issue, having to wait for a guard to open up the door so I could leave the facility to use the bathroom that was in the lobby. But nevertheless, they're unlocked now, but they're guarded. So I'm kind of confused about why they would think that would count as an unsecured facility.
Mm-hmm. Franco, assuming the fear is flight risk, that these folks will disappear into the crowd and not resurface?
Yeah, that is definitely the fear. I mean, talking with the government, you know, they're doing their best to walk back a little bit of the deterrence message, or at least legally, after another lawsuit in February that was decided in D.C. that said you can't use deterrence as a meaning. They've been trying to walk that back, but, you know, it's still a big issue of flight risk, and they point to federal statistics that show that many of the immigrants who get court dates do not show up, and so it's a tough balance to, you know, they have a responsibility to protect the vulnerable, but also need to try to stop those who are not coming for some type of a humanitarian crisis, because there are some others that are coming for economic or family reasons. And it's a tough balance. But the question really is, should children be detained in these type of situations, regardless of the circumstances?
So if they're not showing up for court dates, some of them, where are they going?
Well, I think essentially they're blending into the communities. There's a lot of, you know, large immigrant communities here. I mean, it's an issue that, you know, it's an issue that Central America, we have a long history of Central Americans who have come to this country illegally. So this surge has changed kind of the mindset, or it's caused a little bit of a difficulty of thinking about it in a different way. I don't think everybody can grasp the humanitarian crisis that's going down there without actually being down there and seeing the violence and seeing the changes and seeing the poverty. We have such a long history of this, of these countries, of people coming here fleeing for economic reasons, that I think now it's difficult for members of the public as well, and particularly politicians, to see them as more as refugees who need help and who are vulnerable.
Matthew Archambault, you are representing some of these women and their children. Tell us a little bit about them and their lives, who they are.
Well, you know, most of the people at Berks and that we're talking about come from either Honduras, El Salvador, or Guatemala. Those are three main countries. And they're facing, you know, really, I mean, a lot of it is a domestic violence situation with their partners or even their parents against the young children. And while we don't, maybe the layperson doesn't typically think of that as a basis for asylum, it is. These are members of particular social groups. They're women who are dominated by men thinking that they are their property. And the problem isn't that necessarily, obviously that thinking is a problem. It's the government's reaction to that type of violence against women. And a lot of these countries have laws on the books, but they're not enforced. A woman who's being sexually abused and tortured by her husband can go to the police, and the police will typically do nothing about it. The other problems, and when you put into gangs, the terrible gang problems, the drug trafficker problems in these countries, in these women, mostly women that we're talking about, men and are certainly affected as well, but they're targeted because of the societal perception of women as property. For example, you have a woman who is married to or partner to someone who falls on the wrong side of a gang or the drug traffickers. Mm. Maybe that person flees for his life or is killed. The gangs and the drug traffickers will still take retribution against a woman because that woman is seen as the property of the man. And that is how they harm.
And the children?
And the children. And
the children are involved as well. The children can be harmed as well.
The children can be targeted for harm as well. I had one client whose child was shot at her birthday party by a gang who was taking retribution against her father. And, you know, these are the types of things that they're facing on a day-to-day basis. And we hear a lot about, you know, the administration saying that we want to lock these people up for long periods of time until we can deport them because they have no claim and we want to deter other people from making this, you know, dangerous journey. And it can be a very dangerous journey. But, you know, in all types of migration, we have push and pull factors. And they're claiming that the pull factor of being allowed to walk into the United States and blend into society and live here in the shadows is greater than the push of the violence against them. Mm. And what? Go ahead.
No, I was going to ask if you finish your thought, if you would, because I wanted to go to life inside the residential center. But finish your thought.
Well, when I think of this concept of deterrence that the administration is trying to put out there, I think of if you're inside a burning home with your child, and you realize if I stay inside this burning home, I'm surely going to die. Perhaps I'm lucky enough that a firefighter comes and saves me, but you have no concept. You don't know if that's going to happen. And if you think my only way to get out is to run through the flames, through the door, and then get outside, I may not make it. My child may die. We may both die. My child may be badly burned. You know, all those things. You know, at what do you do? Do you stay and surely die, or do you make an attempt to get out, even sure, when you know that the consequences of being badly burned, you know, is a very severe consequence? These are what these women are facing with their children. So to say that we can deter that human nature of flight from violence to protect your children, I think is wrongheaded.
Sure. Before we get to the what's going on inside the residential center, Franco, what is the trip like for these women and children as they cross the border?
I mean, it's kind of like what Matthew is saying. It's an incredibly difficult trip. These immigrants are coming from Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras. It is such an arduous journey that you know, they're risking their lives in so many different ways. I think many of us often think about the crossing of the desert of Mexican undocumented immigrants. Well, these immigrants are, you know, probably making 3-4 times as difficult of a journey trying to cross over into Mexico, where oftentimes the law enforcement is even harsher than the United States. I mean, this is, they're riding the beast, which is this massive train where thousands of undocumented ride in with their lives in peril. They're just hanging off of it, jumping on, jumping off. And with 2-year-old, 3-year-old children, it's really kind of mind-boggling, hard to fathom why someone would do that. And it's those circumstances that Matthew's talking about that pushes them to.
And then they get to the border and they're picked up by the Border Patrol.
They're picked up by the Border Patrol. Sometimes in many of these cases that we're talking about today, they will go straight to the border porter and say, go straight to the Border Patrol and say, I need help. I need asylum. I'm here seeking asylum. Sometimes it's not just getting caught. Sometimes it's, you know, please help me.
And so when this happens, what happens next? Are they put directly into these residential centers, or do they go before a court before they go to the centers? How does the process work, Matthew?
Well, so, and Franco's right, you know, a lot of my clients will say they're so exhausted from the journey that when they cross over, you know, they just can't do it anymore. And the Border Patrol saves them in many aspects. And actually, we are grateful for that. Then what would happen is that they're processed by the Border Patrol. There's usually kind of an initial interview about, you know, who you are, if you have identity documents, you know, what are they, you know, why are you here? And sometimes, you know, lots of times the women are, they're very scared and they might not reveal exactly why they're coming, their fear. Then they're taken to hold-in areas by the Border Patrol. And these are these large warehouse types of room that people may have seen the pictures of that kind of came out to break this story. Jeleros, and I'm probably, my Spanish isn't great, so Franco can probably say it better than I can. But basically think of a huge concrete room filled with women and children kept at really cold levels. And they're given thin blankets. Sometimes they're given little mattresses to sleep on. Many times they're not, and they're held there for days and sometimes even weeks while they're processed to be moved to these residential centers. And that in itself is really disturbing. And, you know, I'm reading about Cecilia Munoz, who is the immigration policy director for President Obama, and she says she keeps a picture of these children in this situation on her desk. But she hasn't done anything about it.
Okay, we'll pick up on that in just a moment. We're up against a break. We're talking this hour about federal detention centers which hold immigrant women and children. Matthew Archambault is an immigration attorney. Franco Ordonez reports on immigration for McClatchy. And joining us in just a moment, Dan Cadman, a research fellow with the Center for Immigration Studies. If you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499. Back in a moment. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane, and this is Radio Times. Joining us as we talk about immigration policy this hour is Dan Cadman, a research fellow with the Center for Immigration Studies. Dan is also a retired Immigrations and Customs Enforcement official with 30 years of government experience. Welcome, Dan. Do we have Dan with us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I sure can. Welcome. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
Our guests also include immigration attorney Matthew Archambault and Franco Ordonez, who reports on immigration for McClatchy. And I'd like to get to Franco first, because Franco, I know you've talked to some of the women who live inside the Berks County Residential Center. Tell us what life is like inside the center. How is their day-to-day life?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think Matthew could speak to it as well, since his clients are in the facility as well. From my conversations from the women, it's a difficult experience. Many of them are when they sleep, they're given 15-minute bed checks where lights are shined in their faces, are shined in the room. Oftentimes, kids are woken up. Kids, I'm told, are sometimes yelled at because they're being kids and they're not necessarily always following the rules. With so many people, you can imagine that sometimes it's challenging to keep order if you have kids. You know, that's always a challenge. Also, you know, there's cultural issues such as the food. Some of the mothers often told me that the children simply just were not used to the food. It wasn't culturally appropriate. Allegations that the food wasn't properly cooked. You know, these, you know, if you look at the videos that the government has put out, they show these very pristine, beautiful places with state-of-the-art medical equipment, soccer fields. They look very nice, but that doesn't necessarily speak to how these women are being treated. And those, some of those things that, that the women are saying very much are very much contradictory to the images that you see on those videos.
So, Franco, is it your understanding? I mean, are the facilities clean? Is the food good, even if it is not, even if it doesn't work culturally? Are there positives inside the county residential center?
I mean, there's no, I think there's no question that, you know, the soccer field that I saw is very nice. It's gorgeous. The medical equipment looks very beautiful, looks very nice. The pictures that the government put out, again, that the government put out show refrigerators that are stocked with juice boxes, fruit. There are classes. It's kind of like if you talk to the government will say, if you had to, if you absolutely had to house or detain mothers and children, these are the type of facilities that you want. No one wants to detain a mother and a child, especially a child, a two-year-old, a five-year-old. But if you had to, the government will tell you these are the kind of facilities that you want. However, you know, Matthew can talk about his clients and, you know, the treatment from the guards you don't see on camera. And there are some, you know, serious questions and active investigations about some allegations that are very serious.
And we'll get to that in just a moment. But I would like to get Dan Cabman into the conversation. Dan, Judge G's tentative court ruling of last month, the issue here seems to be that these are secure facilities. The immigrant mothers and their children, they do not have the freedom to come and go as they please.
That's undoubtedly true. I don't think anyone would dispute the question that detention is fundamentally a deprivation of liberty in the most essential sense. The question, I think, really becomes, what is the purpose of the detention and is it fulfilling that purpose? And the government finds itself between a rock and a hard place. I am not in a position to speak to the conduct of each and every guard in the facility, but I think by and large, when you're talking about people whose profession it is, and I'm talking about the government officers, to enforce immigration laws, they know better than most people how difficult it is both to enforce the law and to be someone on the back end of detention. They do know. In an ideal world, no one wants to detain women and small children, as Franco said. But the flip side of that is, how do you make sure that people show up for their court proceedings? How do you make sure that if they are ordered removed, that they in fact do depart? And how do you ensure that a trickle doesn't become a flood become a tsunami. And those are some of the issues that result in things like this residential detention center. You can use all kinds of synonyms, but at heart, it's to detain.
Matthew Archambault, Franco and Dan both referenced the guards and allegations of mistreatment by the guards against some of the women and perhaps the children. Can you address that?
Well, I mean, the clearest one was, and she was my client. She was a victim of institutional sexual assault at the Berks County facility by a guard there. And the Berks County facility's response to this was, one, to fire the guard. Thank you. That's nice. And two, to change the clothing policy within. They wanted to, you know, so the women wouldn't be wearing such tight clothing.
Maybe. So there's a dress code.
It they changed it in order to, I guess they said no more tight pants, no more loose shirts, because obviously that was a problem. That was what prompted this guard to conduct himself this way. That's a joke. And it was a joke that that was a response. ICE's response to this victim of a sexual assault was to keep her and her son detained for another 4 months in the same place that she had been victimized. But apart from that, we have guards, you know, yelling at the children, stop running, stop playing. Little violations. The guards are telling the women that they're going to be written up and it's going to be given to the immigration judge and it's going to affect their case. You know, spoiler alert, you know, people don't lose asylum because they refuse to wash the dishes in their facility. It's this type of kind of repressive behavior that is going on that is re-traumatizing these women and these children. And as far as medical care, Franco mentioned the nice medical equipment, and it might look great on videos, but you know, we have situations where a 4 or 5 year old child was vomiting blood at the Berks facility, and the medical response was give the child some more water. Maybe the child's not drinking enough water. They didn't take the child out for medical care. You know, I'm not a doctor. I don't even play one on TV, but when a child is vomiting blood, it seems to me that there's probably a medical condition that should be addressed.
How do you prevent sexual abuse within a facility such as this? Dan Cabman, do you have any ideas?
Well, certainly rigorous training and even more importantly, rigorous screening of the people that are employed there. But in listening to his recitation, I found myself wondering first why the Homeland Security Office of Inspector General wasn't involved and why the local police or sheriff's office wasn't involved, because from the description given, the individual's acts were criminal and should have been prosecuted. And
including the alleged lack of medical attention? For the child
speaking,
that Matthew was talking about?
That sounds like negligence. I was speaking about sexual assault.
Dan, I can address that. And I was just giving a summary. Actually, the ICE investigator did come in, was involved. The local police did come in. And the guard is being prosecuted by the Berks County District Attorney's Office. So, you know, that wasn't really our complaint. We were happy that the local township stepped up and that the Berks County took the prosecution. We would have liked to see the U.S. Attorney take the federal prosecution. But rest assured that has happened.
Franco Ordonez, have you found in talking to the population at the Berks County Residential Center that there are women who are okay with being there?
Well, the calls, I've been getting calls from inside the facility. So the people that are calling me, as often call the media, are not necessarily the people who are content with their circumstances. So it's difficult for me to answer that question. What I can tell you is that the only people who have called me have had very serious concerns about their treatment. From talking with other lawyers, there's been some more newer arrivals who have arrived. The government, in its testimony and its motions in court, they have indicated that there are migrant mothers who are content to be there, who feel that the detention centers, even though they do not want to be in them, that they are better conditions than where they were at home. That is from some of the court testimony. Leon Fresca, one of the deputy from the Justice Department, talked about some of the mothers saying, this is my new home. You know, I think Matthew has a big smirk on his face right now. But those are certainly not the kind of calls that I've been getting.
Let's get to the telephones. Carol Ann from Reading, Pennsylvania is standing by. Welcome, Carol Ann.
Well, hello, and hi to Matthew. And
oh, what did I miss, Carol Ann?
You know each other.
Yes, we do. And I really appreciate you having this topic on today. So far, you haven't missed anything. I just wanted to add, I represent several clients who have been detained at Berks and have been there basically since the beginning when this all started, when we weren't even aware that people were being detained long-term. Prior to the summer, I'm 10 minutes away from the facility in Reading, Pennsylvania, and an immigration attorney, and we didn't even know, nobody needed attorneys really over at the facility because they were only detained for a short period while they were waiting their asylum interview, and then they were released to other family members in the other areas of the country, and they would be ensure that these people would get to their court dates and that they would follow through with their asylum hearings.
So, Carol Ann and Matthew, I have a quick question. How long are these folks being detained on average?
Well, I mean, my client has been there for more than 10 months. Someone was just released who has been more than a year. Carol Ann is probably longer than me, right?
Yeah, I have two clients who just reached a year on May 14th. I have clients who were detained with two-year-olds, three-year-olds for 10 months, you know, of that child's life.
Why does it take so long?
Well, the reason why, especially at Berks, is we are, the people there are people who have already had like at least one removal and then they've returned. And because they have one removal against them, so they came, a lot of times they came for the very same reason they came the second time, out of fear. And then they were deported back and then they turned around and came back again. If they have that prior removal order, then our policy, our current policy, is that they are not entitled to a bond. And so because they're not entitled to a bond, they have to go through their entire court process while they are detained. Even on appeal.
Thank you, Carol Ann, for the telephone call to Radio Times. Matthew?
Sure, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, what was happening before was, what Carol Ann was saying, is that it was a short-term facility. And these families were being reunited with families around the country in a safe place. And we feel that was an appropriate use of the facility because we don't believe that, you know, lots of times the situation that people are going to be going to, you know, might not be the best and it should be checked out. And maybe they should have some medical care. It's a completely different psychological mindset for a parent and a child if they're in a facility like Berks and they know they're being moved out towards a safe place. Even if it's a month or two, psychologically, that's okay. But when they're being told, hey, you're not getting out of here until you're deported, and we don't know how long that's going to take, I think the psychological effect on these women and children is, quite frankly, crushing.
Dan Cadman, one more question before we let you go. So, during the asylum hearing, the choice is either deportation or what else could possibly happen? They can be granted
Let me back it up and go back to something that was said by the caller on the phone, which is that a large number of the individuals have previously been deported. You know, when the government had those individuals in custody at the border, what the government could have done and chose not to do was reinstate the previous order of removal, sidestep the idea of detention, sidestep the idea of holding them for these long backlogs before the immigration court, which has a backlog of nearly 500,000 cases and growing. And they could have reinstated the order and removed the individuals promptly back to their country. One can approve or disapprove of that choice, but the consequence to the individual inevitably is to get caught up in this system that takes 10 months, 12 months, 19 months. And the alternative ultimately for them does become extremely limited, which is to try and prove that they are entitled to asylum, which burden clearly they didn't sustain the first time or they wouldn't have been deported. So the saddest part is that as a statistical matter, the chances are great that they will once again be ordered deported, and that all of the time that they have spent in detention in many fundamental ways will be of questionable value.
Franco Ordonez, what does it take to be granted asylum?
You know, I mean, the rules, they make them very difficult. You basically have certain parameters. I think Matt, you could probably help me out here, but there's different types of persecution, domestic violence, as he had said. Matthew, could you help me out here, actually? I think there's five main reasons, which is religious persecution.
The five protected grounds are race, religion, ethnicity, nationality, and a particular membership in a particular social group, which has been defined as basically a mutable characteristic that one cannot change or should not be required to change. And so you have to show that for asylum. There are basically three reliefs that we're talking about. Asylum would be for people who have entered for the first time, and withholding in CAT would be for people who have maybe have a reinstatement or have some other type of bar.
All right, we'll continue with that thought after the break here on Radio Times. We have to say goodbye to Dan Cabman. It was great to have you join us, Dan.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Dan is a research fellow at the Center for Immigration Studies. Matthew Archambault is an immigration attorney. And Franco Ordonez is immigration reporter for McClatchy. If you'd like to join the conversation, jump in, 888-477-9499, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moscowane. Matthew Archambault is here with us. He's an immigration attorney. And Franco Ordonez is immigration reporter for McClatchy. We are talking about migrant women and children being held at the Berks County Residential Center and what is happening with them. 888-477-9499 is the telephone number if you'd like to give a comment or if you have a question. And before we headed into the break, we were talking about what it takes to achieve asylum when a woman goes before the court and asks for asylum. How does the court determine that she actually has a case and that is telling the truth?
Well, I think you need to back up to what happens before. Each person that comes in is given either a credible fear interview by the asylum office to see if they can state kind of a prima facie claim.
What's credible fear, Matthew?
A credible fear interview would be that they state why they're afraid to go back. They're questioned extensively by the asylum officer. The asylum officer will determine if that person is credible in according to country conditions, if the story sounds right, it sounds like they're being consistent and telling the truth. And if they have expressed a fear that is based on one of the five protected grounds, it's kind of a threshold determination that will allow the person to go in before the immigration judge. And just as a clarification, all these women and children and men that come in and are stopped, they're all given expedited removals right away, expedited removal orders right away. The people that have been deported in the past, their orders are reinstated right away. And then if they express a fear, they're either moved to the credible fear, that would be for first-time arrivals for asylum, or reasonable fear, those would be for people who had their who have had their orders reinstated. And the people for reasonable fear would be in what they called withholding only proceedings, which the burden is a little bit higher than the asylum. So that's kind of the initial, that's where you have to go before you get to talk to an immigration judge about your claim.
It's a long, complicated process. Essentially, when the woman goes before the judge in the court, it's really her word that the official has to take before asylum is granted, correct? I mean, how do you prove otherwise?
Well, I mean, sometimes you can have some documentation. You know, sometimes there may be police reports or hospital reports or other things, you know, affidavits from people from back home. But essentially, you're right. It's going to come down to that, usually that woman's word in court. And the government has an attorney who will aggressively cross-examine these women and look for any inconsistencies they can find. And then if the woman is found to be credible, then the judge has to decide, does she fall into one of these five protected grounds? And generally speaking, in these cases, it is either a membership, usually a family membership protected class, or, you know, women who are being dominated by men in their societies, a domestic violence claim. You know, those are really what it comes down to. But you're right. It will come down to that woman's testimony.
Franco Ordonez, my understanding is that federal officials are threatening to split up mothers and children if the government is eventually asked to dismantle the detention centers. Is that correct?
Yeah. This is a serious issue. I mean, the government is not backing down. You referenced the draft order by the federal court in California, who basically said that what this practice does violate this 1997 settlement. And the government's response is, well, you are pushing us to follow our own statutes that say we have to split up the mothers and children. And according to the government, this, they have no choice because, as Matthew was saying earlier, these are women who have, are, you know, quote unquote, essentially, I guess, repeat offenders who have entered the country before and been removed. And the statutes specify that they have to be detained. Now, there are different ways that they could be detained. And there is a debate about that, about whether they could use ankle bracelets, for example. But the government seems to be very really digging in its heels to say, you know, we will continue to hold the mothers, and they feel that you know, lawyers are basically playing a little bit of game of Russian roulette, that if you force us to close down these family detention centers, you think we're going to release the mothers, and we're not. So,
well, where would the mothers and children go if they were split up?
The mothers could be held, continue to be held in different detention centers. I think they could still be held. I mean, they're different offenders. They have different immigration detention centers all across the country, different levels of quality. I think there's the question of what will happen to the children. Some may go to family, some may go to foster care. But I think it's a big issue, and it's actually permeated the walls of some of these detention centers, where mothers are actually hearing this type of news and they're getting very nervous.
We've been talking about mothers and children. Where are the fathers in this? Do we know?
Well, sometimes the fathers are with them. You know, there are in Berks, there are fathers, and sometimes we talk about mothers, and I don't want to forget about the fathers that are also detained. But oftentimes, you know, the fathers have either abandoned their family, or the fathers are actually the reason that they're here. They're the abusers that caused them to flee.
We have an email from Lisa who says, in reference to your guest's comments about choosing to detain people, what do you think privatization of our prison system has to do with that?
Well, I mean, the Carnes and the Dilley facility are private prison companies, and they're huge facilities, and they were built overnight in order to accommodate these family units.
And Dilley's in Texas.
Dilley, right? And Carnes, yeah, are both in Texas. Mm-hmm. One is run by CCA, the other is run by the Geo Group. And I think it is a huge issue as regards to immigration detention in itself. And yeah, I mean, it's a moneymaker. And even the Berks facility, it's run by the county. It's not run by the private company, but, you know, it's a jobs program for the Berks County. They receive money, you know, close to $300 a day for each detainee that is in there. It provides jobs for the local community. And, you know, from a personal standpoint, you know, I don't think detention should be, especially of children, should be tied to a jobs program.
And these detention facilities, there are plans to expand them?
Berks is en route to double in capacity within a month or so. They're building every day. Carnes and Dilley are not up to full capacity. I believe it was a Geo Group that is running at 35% capacity at its facility, and they're already reporting, you know, they reported their great profits that they made just at that level. So the push for this type of detention, you know, is coming, we feel, a lot from the prospect of making more money off of these, you know, children and mothers. And, fathers.
It's pretty amazing, Amir, if you think about it. A year ago, the Berks facility was really the only facility in existence. And even at that time, it was kind of a sleepy, not underused place. It had 100 beds, but I think Matthew could tell you, you know, it was not to full capacity. And that was the only family detention center operating in the country. People would stay there, you know, maybe a few days, a couple of weeks, maybe a month, as Carol Ann was talking about earlier, and then moved on. We've gone from that one facility to now that facility going to double in size. Mm. We have the Dilley facility in Texas. We have the Carnes facility in Texas. We used to have a facility, Artesia, in New Mexico, that was closed under some controversy. And we're going to go from one facility that had under 100 people to soon having facilities of holding 3,000 mothers and children. I mean, that's a major change in a span of less than 12 months.
Okay, let's get to the phones. Mac in Downingtown has been standing by. Hello, Mac.
Hi there. I guess my question is for the lawyer. Isn't it a fact that these people could, you know, who are complaining that they don't like the food, it's not culturally supportive, and they can't come and go as they like, all they have to say is, send me home, I won't come back, and they'd be out of there tomorrow. Why should we feel sorry for people who have broken the law and keep breaking it and then complain about being caught?
Okay, Mac, thank you for the call to Radio Times. Matthew?
Well, seeking asylum here in the United States is not illegal. It's a perfectly acceptable way to migrate to this country. It's codified in our laws under Section 208 and 241 of the Immigration and Nationality Act. So, you know, the caller, you know, I hear this a lot. And, you know, I mean, maybe the caller should just admit to himself that he doesn't like these types of people and move on with it. I mean, the fact is that these people are fleeing repressive violence. Things are awful in their countries. They're here because they don't want to be killed. They don't want their children killed. They don't want to be raped anymore. They don't want their children raped anymore. So, yeah.
But, you know, you almost have to understand it. And let's take aside the allegations of sexual abuse and of negligence. If those were gone, you know, you've been in a violent situation. You feared for your life. And now you're in a facility that's relatively clean. Your children are going to school. You have food. I would think that probably is a good place for some of these women. I kind of, not that I understand where he's coming from, but is that a point?
It's a point. Everyone makes points. I don't think it's a valid point after you work with these women and children. Long-term indefinite detention, and indefinite meaning not knowing when it's going to end. It's not, indefinite isn't tied to a time period, is psychologically crushing on these individuals. I work with a lot of parents who are detained without their children in regular detention, and with the parents who are detained with their children. And the psychological effects on them is much greater. The psychological effects on the children is crushing. My 2-year-old client cries all the time, weeping to go home, to leave. He won't eat. He's losing weight. But his mother knows if he does as Mac from Downingtown would like her to do, say, all right, let's pick up and go back to Guatemala, that she'll probably end up being raped again, being killed. Her son would be targeted. So what are her choices? We're a better country than this, we have other ways. And Franco mentioned ankle bracelets, other ways. Mm-hmm. That's certainly a way. But what I would like to propose is that we do something maybe a little bit different, that we try to integrate these people into society, that we give them work authorizations, and we tie work authorization to them going to court, to them reporting to ICE, to give them, to keep them on our radar screen. Because so often they're given a notice and they're left, and they have nothing to their devices. They can't get work authorization, and we can't keep track of them. We can keep track of them absent imprisonment of them and their children, and also absent of ankle bracelets that are dehumanizing.
Franco Ordonez, spring and summer are usually when we see the most people crossing the border?
Yes, absolutely. A lot of the majority of the migrants start coming in March, April, and that you know, I guess quote unquote season continues through the summer into the fall. It's as the as the warmer months come in, the cold kind of dissipates in the winter. They start coming warmer months when construction, agriculture, hospitality jobs are going on, and that's one of the one of the big reasons that the government is very concerned about trying to keep their options to have family detention centers open through at least the summer. I think the government will tell you they know that their backs are against the wall and that they're fighting an uphill battle now after this court draft ruling. And they really want to keep the numbers, keep that option open through the summer until the numbers dropped, because we're expecting, the government is expecting another large surge of migrants from Central America who are fleeing violence.
And when you say a large surge, what are we talking? What's the guesstimate?
So the guesstimate is about, I think it's about 40,000 mothers and children. That does not include the unaccompanied children. So I think the ranges are from about 35,000 to about 44,000.
I'd like to get this tweet in from Sophia before we wrap up.
Sure.
Are there any nonprofit or volunteer organizations providing educational and other services to the children? Do you know of anything?
Well, I do. Well, one, I'm providing legal services pro bono, and a lot of lawyers have been doing that. AILA, American Immigration Lawyers Association, has a pro bono effort in Carnes and Dilley, and their people are trying to get in there to help.
Okay, a definitive ruling on this issue should come down right over the next week or so. That's what we're hearing. If you had to guess, which way do you think it's going to go?
No, I mean I think the judge has been leaning that this type of family detention is unlawful and contrary to the settlement in Flores. And I believe that they will come up with a settlement that will lead to the end of family detention. And if not, we're ready, at least here in Pennsylvania, to go to court and to challenge this Obama policy that we feel is inhumane and unjust and also illegal.
Franco, quick thought from you.
Yeah, in Pennsylvania, I think it's very interesting. I think the attorneys are very confident that they have the upper hand in Texas. But in Pennsylvania, where it's a so-called unsecure licensed facility, there's still a lot of question marks there.
Franco Ordonez, immigration reporter for McClatchy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And Matthew Archambault, it was a pleasure.
Thank you, Mary.
I appreciate your presence here. Matthew's an immigration attorney representing some of the women being detained at the Berks County Residential Center. And this reminder, visit our Facebook page and check out our podcasts by heading to our homepage, whyy.org/radiotimes. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscowane. Hour 2 is just ahead.